This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Hello, sorry about that slight mix-up in the sound there. It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 7 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. This is World in Focus. And coming up on today's programme, the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom has ruled that Parliament will now have to vote on the triggering of Article 50, which officially sets the Brexit negotiations in process. So what exactly will this mean for the type of Brexit Britain will embark on? And what does the additional ruling that devolves Parliament should have no veto mean for the likes of Scotland and Northern Ireland, both of which voted overwhelmingly to stay inside the EU? Gloom has descended on the British financial sector, according to a report by business group CBI and accounting firm PwC. Optimism amongst the UK's banks has fallen for a fourth consecutive quarter. This marks the longest period of decline in sentiment towards the sector since the financial crisis of 2008, and most point to the Brexit vote as being the cause. One of US President Donald Trump's first executive orders was signed yesterday, ensuring that the United States will indeed be pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. We'll be looking at the future, if there is one, of the TPP without its biggest trading partner. The mainstream media reports of extra funds for the EU's counter-propaganda unit amount to fake news after it emerged no extra cash would be provided to help EU officials identify alleged Russian propaganda. And should MEPs be looking more closely at the European Union's communications strategy amid growing dissatisfaction with the European trading bloc? And he was a billionaire, I was a bellboy. Can I make it any more obvious? Just how likely is Trump erotic fiction likely to make it onto your summer reading list? All that and more over the next hour on this Tuesday edition of World in Focus.
By a majority of 8-3, the Supreme Court rules that the government cannot trigger Article 50 without an Act of Parliament authorising it to do so.
Britain's Supreme Court ruling that the decision over triggering the mechanism for leaving the EU must be taken by Parliament and not by UK Prime Minister Theresa May's government alone. And that was the announcement this morning read by Lord Neuberger.
Section 2 of the 1972 Act provides that whenever EU institutions make new laws, those new laws become part of UK law. The 1972 Act therefore makes EU law an independent source of UK law until Parliament decides otherwise. Therefore, when the UK withdraws from the EU treaties, a source of UK law will be cut off. Further, certain rights enjoyed by UK citizens will be changed. Therefore, the government cannot trigger Article 50 without Parliament authorising that course.
Lord Neuberger, and the decision now means that instead of being a simple matter for the government to control the Brexit negotiations process, it will likely become a political ballgame as the negotiations continue. It leaves the way open for MPs who wanted to remain in the EU to table amendments to the Brexit legislation at any stage and seek to have a hand in the negotiations at every stage and forge their own brand of Brexit. The case was brought by UK businesswoman Gina Miller and others who argued that the Prime Minister Theresa May and her government did not have the authority to trigger Article 50 of the Treaty of Lisbon, the process of actually leaving the EU without an Act of Parliament voted on by all MPs. Here is Gina Miller speaking this morning outside of the Supreme Court in London.
No Prime Minister, no government can expect to be unanswerable or unchallenged. Parliament alone is sovereign. This ruling today means that MPs we have elected will rightfully have the opportunity to bring their invaluable experience and expertise to bear in helping the government select the best course in the forthcoming Brexit negotiations. Negotiations that will frame our place in the world and all our destinies to come. There is no doubt that Brexit is the most divisive issue of a generation. But this case was about the legal process, not politics. Today's decision has created legal certainty based on our democratic process and provides the legal foundations for the government to trigger Article 50.
UK businesswoman Gina Miller, one of the main figures behind the case against the government, speaking this morning after the Supreme Court ruled that MPs must vote on the triggering of Article 50, which will begin the Brexit process. Somewhat surprisingly, given the emphasis that Brexit supporters have placed on the sovereignty of the UK Parliament, many see this as an anti-democratic betrayal of the will of the electorate as delivered in last year's EU referendum in June. As a result of that bad feeling, Gina Miller also spoke this morning of the level of abuse that she and her team had allegedly faced from those opposed to the ruling.
In Britain, we are lucky, we are fortunate to have the ability to voice legitimate concerns and views as part of a shared society. I have therefore been shocked by the levels of personal abuse that I have received from many quarters over the last 7 months for simply ringing and asking a legitimate question. I sincerely hope that going forwards, people who stand in positions of power and profile are much quicker in condemning those who cross the lines of common decency and mutual respect.
Gina Miller speaking outside of the UK's Supreme Court in London this morning. One of the other rulings reached by the court concerned the devolved parliaments of Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland and whether or not they should have any say over the triggering of Article 50. Lord Neuberger again.
The court unanimously rules that UK ministers are not legally compelled to consult the devolved legislatures before triggering Article 50. The devolution statutes were enacted on the assumption that the UK would be a member of the EU, but they do not require it. Relations with the EU are a matter for the UK government. The Sewell Convention plays an important part in the operation of the UK constitution, but the policing of its scope and its operation is not a matter for the courts.
Lord Neuberger speaking this morning as a part of his announcement of the Supreme Court's ruling on how the UK government should proceed in triggering Article 50 and setting the ball rolling officially for Brexit negotiations. That last point there will come as a blow in particular to the parliaments of Scotland and Northern Ireland, both of which voted overwhelmingly to remain inside of the European Union. And it now places a great deal of pressure on the administration in Scotland, whose First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has hinted very heavily that in this circumstance she would be left with no other option but to hold a referendum on Scotland's independence from the United Kingdom in order to keep it inside of Europe.
The UK as a whole voted to come out, but Scotland and indeed Northern Ireland voted to stay in. That's why we've brought forward compromise proposals to effectively, if you like, square that circle. We've long been told that the UK is a partnership of equals with all of the four nations that make it up. But if we're now being told that Scotland's voice simply doesn't matter, that it will not be heard, it will not be listened to, not just that it's not enforceable in the courts, but it's not going to be politically listened to, then that raises a really fundamental question for Scotland. Are we happy to allow our future to be dictated by a Westminster government with one MP in Scotland, or is it time to take our future into our own hands?
Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon speaking earlier today in an interview with BBC Scotland on how she intends to proceed now that the Supreme Court has ruled out any veto power for the Scottish Parliament in the triggering of Brexit negotiations, despite the fact that Scotland voted so overwhelmingly to remain inside of the European Union. A complex ruling and a historic day in all, I'm sure you'd agree. And thankfully, to help us make sense of it all, I'm joined on the line now from London by our very own Jim Ensom, who has been following the many twists and turns of this story from the beginning. Jim, before we get into the nitty-gritty of what today's ruling means, I wonder if you could give us an idea of the history behind it.
Well, as you know, on June the 23rd, 2016, there was a referendum held on the membership of the European Union, and it came out as 52% to get out, in other words, to trigger Brexit, and 48% to remain. That in itself was a slight problem because that's the UK-wide result. And in fact, Scotland and Northern Ireland voted to remain, while England and Wales voted to Brexit. That triggered a case brought by UK businesswoman Gina Miller and some others, and they said, well, okay, the method for triggering Brexit is under Article 50 of the Treaty of Lisbon, which has now been brought into the Treaty of the European Union. And that which I rather suspect was written on a fag packet at 4 o'clock in the morning sometime ages ago, because nobody ever thought it was going to happen.
Cynic, Jim.
Absolutely. And that basically says, you know, rule one, anyone can leave and they need to tell us, but to tell us they need to trigger Article 50. Rule two, when Article 50 has been triggered, we will start negotiating how we negotiate a country out. And then rule three is, you know, whenever we're talking about negotiating, they can't talk to us and they can no longer appear, which is why Theresa May, for instance, the UK Prime Minister, has been debarred from certain parts of meetings. So when the rest of them, the other 27 countries, are discussing it, Britain can't be there while negotiations are on to negotiate their way out of the EU, but much, much more importantly, their way back into what their new relationship will be. And that's the problem with Brexit. So what happened was Gina Miller and friends said to the High Court originally, they said, well, hang on a minute, Theresa May herself and her government, which is the government in power, they are trying to use what's called Crown prerogative to trigger the mechanism. So she says, I have the right to trigger it. But Parliament said, no, hang on a minute. This is what Gina Miller's saying. She said, no, it surely must go to a vote in Parliament first, because Parliament is sovereign and you can't use the Crown prerogative. Crown prerogative, by the way, Jack, dates back many, many hundreds of years to the days when England and Wales and Scotland and all that had kings and queens who decided what to do before Parliament. Then Parliament took over and Parliament now writes the statutes and the legislation. But there are some residual powers that allow individual governments to take the Crown prerogative. Now, in fact, what happens with Europe is when we enter into international treaties, etc., the government is allowed to make those decisions using the Crown prerogative. And the question in law that the Supreme Court had to deal with was whether or not Theresa May's government had the right to press the button without asking Parliament. And the result was quite clear. The Supreme Court went 8-3. It was a majority ruling that, yes, it has to go to Parliament. And that's significant.
Now, despite the fact that there is a great deal of opposition from pro-Brexiters about this, there are very few people who would seriously think that Parliament are going to vote against the triggering of Article 50. Given that, what is the significance of this?
Well, it's highly unlikely. You see, every MP, Member of Parliament in Westminster, and in the devolved governments as well, they've got to respect the fact that the referendum voted for out. That's the whole UK-wide one. There are real, real problems, as you very well know, in Scotland and also in Northern Ireland. But the reality is, how can you be a sitting MP and try and vote against Article 50 when a referendum decided you should invoke Article 50? The British public said they wanted out of Europe, and that's what they must deliver. But the problem, the real problem here, is the fact that under law, the legal analysis from the Supreme Court was it must first go to the Parliament to officially trigger it, means that actually Parliament could start to put some amendments in it. So that while Theresa May and David Davis, the Secretary of State for Brexit, whilst they go to negotiate their way through, Article 50, I need to say, originally states that you must get this over within 2 years. You can extend it, but that's problematic. But basically, the ticking bomb is off now. When she presses the button, they've got 2 years. And the problem with this ruling is that now it goes back to being a political ball game, in that theoretically speaking, quite a lot of people could start to throw in loads and loads of amendments, which would mean that Theresa May and David Davis and Boris Johnson as Foreign Secretary would be making the negotiations with Brussels with one hand tied behind their back, because Parliament could well be saying, oh, you can't do that. Ask them this, ask them that. And I've spoken to several people this morning, you know, lecturers in European political law, and they're saying, actually, there is a grave possibility that Parliament in that two-year period could end up by causing a slowdown in the negotiations and so many problems that you could end up after 2 years with a Brexit that isn't managed, because they simply confused the negotiating process, and that's the danger.
I wonder if I could just lastly ask you, because we don't have very much time, so it's literally will have to be a minute or so at most, but obviously the issue of Scotland continues to be there on the sidelines, and in Scotland it's very much centre stage. The First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, whom we heard a clip of just before there speaking about it, has consistently said since the vote last June that there would be these various conditions and the ultimate position of Scotland would have to be a second referendum on independence if none of them are met. Now, it kind of looks like she's run out of breathing space. There are, all of these conditions have not been met. Is this the final straw for Scotland?
I don't think it is, to be quite frank with you. Although the Supreme Court ruled out the fact that Article 50 must be put back to the devolved assemblies and parliaments of Scotland and Northern Ireland, where it's very, very important, the Scottish National Party have suggested that their 54 MPs will vote against the bill, but the Conservatives under Theresa May have got a majority, so that will get through. But
and the opposition Labour Party have said that they will also, by and large, vote in favour as well.
They will vote in favour, that's right. But the problem we've got is that it depends on how they play it, and it depends entirely on what the bill is that's put before them, because the Scottish National Party could just throw amendment after amendment into it to try and get the best Brexit for Scotland. And that could ruin the negotiation process. I don't think this is over by a long shot.
Well, Jim Ensom, thank you.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Coming up on the programme, gloom has descended on the British financial sector. According to a report by business group CBI and accounting firm PwC, optimism amongst the UK's banks has fallen for a fourth consecutive quarter. This marks the longest period of decline in sentiment towards the sector since the financial crisis of 2008, and most point to the Brexit vote as being the cause. We'll have more on that and more in a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will kill myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4pm in the UK, 11am Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker and muckraker from bradblog.com. Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys
when and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast, every day, right here on Radio Sputnik.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk programme has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman programme.
Oddly enough, it's not non-fiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman program on Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights, on Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, gloom has descended on the British financial sector. According to a report by business group CBI and accounting firm PwC, optimism among the UK's banks has fallen for a fourth consecutive quarter. This marks the longest period of decline in sentiment towards the sector since the financial crisis of 2008, and most are pointing to the Brexit vote as being the cause. Talks held in the Kazakh capital of Astana today between rebel factions and the Syrian government have resulted in a declaration between the two sides agreeing a mechanism that will maintain the current Syrian truce. But does the lack of direct US engagement in the talks signal a new change of policy towards Syria from the White House? And my loins trembled as the scent of toupee adhesive and spray tan swept through my nasal cavity. Just another taster there of the new Trump-themed erotic fiction, The Billionaire and the Bellboy. Gloom in Britain's financial services sector has deepened at its sharpest rate since the 2008 financial crisis. That's according to the latest survey of 103 financial services firms by business group CBI and accounting firm PwC. 9 out of 10 of those surveyed said that the UK's vote to leave the European Union was the biggest challenge the sector faced. But just what impact has the Brexit vote had so far? Carolyn Scott has this report.
The quarterly study by business group CBI showed that optimism in the UK's financial sector has dropped for the fourth consecutive quarter. This marks the longest continual drop since the 2008 financial crash. The study also revealed that 90% of banks surveyed see Brexit as their main challenge. On Monday, it was reported that US banks Morgan Stanley and Citigroup have said they could relocate staff to Europe in the wake of Brexit. This comes amid continued speculation and threats of big companies relocating, threats which may get louder now that the UK Prime Minister Theresa May has outlined the plan for Brexit and asserted that Britain will be leaving the single market. However, the full Brexit effect hasn't quite hit yet, with Theresa May still yet to trigger Article 50 and start the formal talks to take Britain out of the EU. So just what impact has Brexit had on the sector so far? Well, that's the question I put to Josh Ryan Collins, a senior economist at the New Economics Foundation.
Well, so far it hasn't had a huge impact. There's been lots of threats from the UK banking sector that they will shift jobs outside London if we have a sort of hard Brexit and we lose membership of the single market. But in terms of actual impact, I think it's made very little difference. Nobody's actually really moved any significant numbers as yet.
Yeah, we've heard a lot of warnings, especially recently from JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs. Do you think those warnings will come to fruition as Article 50 is triggered?
I think there's a good chance that some jobs and some activities will leave the UK. I mean, we do a huge amount of derivatives clearing, hedging activity here, for example. But you've got to think about the bigger picture here and how much impact that would really have on the economy. So of the roughly 400,000 people that work in the UK's banking sector, most actually don't work in the sort of more international investment banking area where membership of the EU would certainly have an impact. Most of them work in retail banking. And even of those who work in wholesale banking, which is a technical term for investment banking, basically, our estimates is only around 20% of the 120,000 jobs in that sector could be at risk. So I think the key thing actually is, what are we going to do? And this is a good day to be talking about this with the industrial strategy being published by the government. What are we going to do to reform our financial system so that it better supports domestic productivity and the real economy and businesses, small businesses and larger firms, to create jobs in the regions outside of London where most of the existing banking profits are made, and helps us reinvent the economy really for a post-Brexit world?
As you say there, a lot of the banking jobs are internal, so they're not likely to be lost internationally. But to look at the UK's financial services, and we now know that the plan for Brexit is to leave the single market entirely. Just how big an impact would that have on the UK's internal financial services?
Well, it's very hard to tell exactly what the impact would be, because we don't know as yet exactly what a so-called hard Brexit would mean. I mean, Theresa May mentioned certain sectors of the economy should be seeking to get special deals with the EU, and finance, unsurprisingly, was one of those sectors, along with automotive industry. So I wouldn't want to sort of second guess that at this stage. I think there is a danger that if too much emphasis is put on sort of saving the financial sector and an approach of sort of low removing regulations on finance, for example, or removing, improving the tax environment, we could end up in a situation where we don't remove our dependency on finance. We become more dependent on it, and we become more dependent on a particular kind of speculative finance rather than the type of finance I was just talking about, which is boring old lending to businesses to invest in jobs and investment productivity. I think that's the risk.
I know that you said a moment ago, if the big banks like JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs did move out, it wouldn't be a huge percentage of the jobs. But if they did move, you know, who in the European Union would benefit from this? Who stands to gain?
Well, it would depend where they went. You know, one place they could go, the two obvious places probably in Europe are Paris and Frankfurt, where there's already a significantly sized financial sort of hub. But there's also a strong chance they might shift operations elsewhere. They might lose some jobs to Singapore, for example, or Hong Kong, or even Tokyo. So, yeah, I mean, France and Germany, I would say, would be the two countries most likely to gain in the short term. But then again, there's this longer term question of whether you really want your economy to be driven by the interests of high finance, much of which is, you know, makes a lot of money and maybe you get a bit of tax out of it as a national economy. But in the long term, it's not clear that sort of activity creates jobs and creates a more sustainable economy.
And just finally, the most commonly used term when we talk about Brexit and the financial markets is that eventually Brexit will lead to a slump in the pound, which will make imports more expensive, which will push up inflation and hold back consumer spending. How grounded analysis do you think that is?
Well, there's certainly more than a grain of truth in that analysis. The fall in the pound will likely lead to inflation. You know, the price of imported goods will rise. Businesses will probably pass that on to consumers in the form of higher prices. Energy costs are rising as well, separate from the fall in the pound. So I think there is going to be a squeeze on consumer spending, and consumer spending has been the thing that's been propping up the UK economy and the services sector in particular for, you know, arguably the last sort of decade since the financial crisis. And again, actually, that's a reason why we need a different kind of financial system. You know, our financial system's very good at lending high interest rates short term to consumers to keep buying stuff that's made in other countries. What we need is a financial sector that's actually going to invest to British businesses and Scottish businesses to invest themselves in innovative products and services and more capital investment. And we really don't have that. Only 10% of all bank lending in the United Kingdom actually supports non-financial businesses. That's a very low amount. Most people probably think it's, you know, 60-70% of lending goes to businesses. That's a myth. Most lending in this country goes against property or to other financial corporations.
Well, Josh, thank you so much for joining us today. Very interesting to hear your thoughts.
Okay, thanks very much. It's a pleasure.
Josh Ryan Collins, Senior Economist at the New Economics Foundation, speaking to me there about the impact that Brexit vote is having on the UK's financial sector. As the CBI report shows, the optimism in the sector has dropped for the fourth quarter in a row. Carolyn Scott, World in Focus.
You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 28 minutes past the hour. A declaration agreed in Kazakhstan today between the Syrian government and rebel factions in the country will continue a fragile ceasefire and leaves the door open for further talks that could end the bitter Syrian civil war. Crucially, the rebel side agreed to have Russia serve as the guarantor of the current ceasefire in a move that further underlines the lack of US and UN influence in the region. Although the US sent its ambassador to Kazakhstan to observe the proceedings, the White House decided to take no direct active role in the Astana negotiations. So is this the start of a new US policy of disengagement from the Syrian conflict? Our reporter Mark Hurst has been finding out.
A Russian and Turkish-sponsored ceasefire between the government of Syria and representatives of the country's rebel factions will continue following indirect talks between the two sides held in the Kazakh capital of Astana today. The negotiations are remarkable as they were agreed and held without any direct involvement of either the UN, US or EU, although those bodies did send observers to monitor the talks. Crucially, the rebels agreed to allow Russia to serve as a guarantor of the current ceasefire, a development that further highlights America's diminishing influence in the conflict. But does this new approach to conflict resolution, excluding the UN and US, potentially provide the world with an alternative model for delivering peace? And does the lack of US involvement in particular signal a new policy towards Syria from the new US President Trump? That is a question I put earlier to Simon Reich, a professor at the Division of Global Affairs at Rutgers University in Newark.
If candidate Trump was to be believed, then President Trump will clearly initiate a more forceful and aggressive position regarding Syria. But of course, his focus was largely on what we would broadly characterize as members of individual components of the rebel group. So to the extent that there is any involvement, either formally or more likely, as you say, informally, it will be discussion about potentially how to coordinate the American and Russian position in Syria moving forward.
Do you think that perhaps grudgingly there's an acceptance in Washington that the US have been outmaneuvered by the Russians during the conflict?
Yeah, it's a great question. America at the moment is apoplectic about every tweet that Donald Trump offers. So it's always hard to distinguish which we should take seriously and which we should disregard. In his comments as a candidate, he seemed to suggest that then President Obama had been outmaneuvered. Whether now he's in office, he believes that to be the case, and whether he's going to accept that as a fait accompli moving forward is, of course, a different question. It's quite clear that he's trying to establish a reset or a rapprochement with the Russians that will involve coordination over such issues. You know, the principal question we have to ask is how long will that rapprochement last? And that's not clear at present.
And some indication again during the campaign trail that he might seek for the US to have a more isolationist role in terms of, or non-interventionist role in a global sense. But given the US has a very significant global footprint, that's going to be a difficult thing to achieve in terms of rollback.
Well, it's an interesting point that, just to be clear, it depends on what you characterize, what you define as a base. But if you use the broader definition, the United States has well over 500, and according to some estimates, 700 globally. I don't think that we can characterize the president's position as being isolationist. He certainly has isolationist elements to him, focusing, for example, on border control. That's a big component of isolationism. But I think that the global footprint will remain. It'll just take on a different form, focus, and tone. This morning in Washington, there were reports, and indeed in Britain, there were reports about the Chinese being very upset about Rex Tillerson, the new Secretary of State's comments about the South China Sea. I think we'll see a more forceful position in many ways from the United States globally. Perhaps a little bit more selective, certainly a less of a focus on negotiation and bargaining, but undoubtedly a much greater use of American military forces, not necessarily to intervene in terms of actually getting involved in wars, but certainly to maintain a high profile in what they regard as key areas. One of the questions, of course, will be, which are these key areas? The administration has signaled very early that the South China Sea is one. The question for the Russians will be whether they ultimately regard Central and Eastern Europe as a key area as well.
And within the last few hours, we've had a statement issued in Astana suggesting there's agreement on a new mechanism to maintaining the ceasefire. And interestingly, the rebel forces have agreed that that Russia will act as guarantor in terms of that ceasefire. Is that another signal that US influence in the Syrian conflict is diminishing?
Well, I think that the administration has clearly signaled its priorities in the region, and its priority in the region is not Syria. So it wouldn't surprise me to learn that they have deferred to the Russians in terms of letting the Russians police and enforce any agreement that takes place. The administration has focused quite clearly on ISIS and it will be involved, if its words to be believed, throughout the region in fighting against jihadist forces, whether that's in Yemen, Iraq, or indeed elements of Syria. But clearly, where they can parlay that role into by laying it off to purported allies in this fight, such as Russia, I think they're going to be perfectly happy to do so.
And do you think this model of conflict resolution is still at a very early stage, of course? Do you think that model is, that doesn't include the US, doesn't include the United Nations, is one we might see rolled out in other conflict areas of the world?
Candidly, that's really hard to judge at this early stage. The Russians, despite their activism, play a key role, obviously, in Europe and in aligning areas such as the Middle East. It's hard to imagine that they will play that key role more broadly globally. It's possible, because all things at the moment seem possible, that the Chinese might play an increasingly large role in those kinds of negotiations.
Professor Simon Reich, many thanks for speaking to us today on World in Focus.
My pleasure.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Coming up on the programme, one of US President Donald Trump's first executive orders was signed yesterday, ensuring that the United States will indeed be pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. We'll be looking at the future, if there is one, of the TPP without its biggest trading partner. That and more in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
The plight of the Palestinian people shames a world that has, for decades, turned its back on justice and international law in service to exceptionalism where they are concerned. Compounding their suffering is a narrative proffered by Israel and supported by Western governments that it is Israel, a military superpower and advanced economy, rather than the Palestinians who are under threat of extinction. Join me, John White, for the next episode of Hard Facts.
Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, one of US President Donald Trump's first executive orders was signed yesterday, ensuring that the United States will indeed be pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, or TPP. We will be looking at the future, if there is one, for the TPP without its biggest trading partner. Do mainstream media reports of extra funds for the EU's counter-propaganda unit amount to fake news after it emerged that no extra cash would be provided to help EU officials identify alleged Russian propaganda? And should MEPs be looking more closely at the European Union's communication strategy amid growing dissatisfaction with the European trading bloc? And I wanted nothing more than to turn around and see the golden god behind these scents, but I couldn't move. Yes, we'll be having more on the new Trump-themed erotic fiction, The Billionaire and the Bellboy, at the end of the programme. On Friday, just hours after Donald Trump's inauguration, the White House released a trade plan saying that the United States would withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, free trade agreement. And yesterday, the new US President Donald Trump signed an executive order to that effect.
All right, we're going to sign three memorandums right now. The first one is withdrawal of the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Everyone knows what that means, right? We've been talking about this for a long time. Thank you. Okay, great thing for the American worker, what we just did.
US President Donald Trump signing the executive order that effectively kills the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. During his presidential campaign, Trump often criticized the TPP agreement and called it a, quote, terrible deal, which is harmful for US workers. He vowed to withdraw the United States from the deal within the first 100 days of his presidency and impose tariffs on products from China. Here is the White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer briefing the press on the move.
As the president has said many times, this type of multinational agreement is not in our best interest, and he's moving quickly to advance trade policies that increase the competitiveness of the American worker and manufacturer. This executive action ushers in a new era of U.S. trade policy in which the Trump administration will pursue bilateral trade opportunities with allies around the globe. This is a strong signal that the Trump administration wants free and fair trade throughout the world.
White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer briefing the press on President Trump's executive order to withdraw the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. The TPP free trade deal, covering 40% of the global economy, was signed last February by Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, Vietnam and the United States. Its future now looks uncertain, although some members have been raising the possibility of a continued partnership without the United States, notably, for example, Australia. Here is the Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull.
We already have a China-Australia free trade agreement. Certainly there is the potential for China to join the TPP.
Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull talking about a potential continuation of the TPP partnership in the wake of America's withdrawal. Positive though the noise is coming from his office might be, his opposite number, the leader of the opposition, Bill Shorten, was quick to dismiss his comments as wishful thinking.
Well, the TPP is dead. How on earth can Mr. Turnbull want to waste the time of the Parliament asking the Parliament to ratify an agreement which includes America when America's not in it? It is just the peak of delusional absurdity. The reason why Mr. Turnbull still insists on pursuing these matters, even though the rest of the world and everyone in Australia knows it's over, is because Mr. Turnbull doesn't have a plan for Australian jobs.
Bill Shorten, leader of Australia's opposition, speaking there about the Prime Minister's comments on a potential continuation of the TPP deal. With me on the line now from Kuala Lumpur is Bala Ramasamy, a professor of economics at the China-Europe International Business School in Shanghai. Thank you for joining us today, Mr. Ramasamy. Would it be premature to say that TPP without the US is now dead?
Yes, I do think so. I think it is dead for some countries, while maybe some other countries might want to keep it alive in some way. What I mean is for countries like Vietnam, like Malaysia, I think without the US, the TPP is of not much use, because the whole idea of TPP for some of these countries was basically a backdoor entry into signing a free trade agreement with the US. So if the U.S. is not going to be there, then I actually don't see the point of pursuing this for some of the countries. Although New Zealand and Australia are talking about TPP minus one, I suppose they're just trying to buy time.
Do you think that's all it is? I mean, there's also other countries like Chile are still talking about trying to make moves towards TPP or whatever it may be called in the future. Would you say they're just trying to buy time too towards finding a better alternative?
Honestly, I think it is buying time for the next 4 years. Until you have another president. Because, I mean, if you look at how effective this agreement is going to be without the US, I mean, really, there are other agreements that are in place. So there is no need for the TPP in order for you to promote trade. The TPP for many of these countries was basically access to the US market. That was the reason. The second reason was, of course, the TPP was a higher level trade agreement, you know, that included things like issues relating to human rights and labor movements and state-owned enterprises and so on. So it was a higher level in that sense. But I think for many of the smaller countries, and most of them were small, other than, you know, maybe the US and Japan. For the other countries, it was basically access to the US market. So without the US, really, you know, it doesn't make sense.
On that point of what you said there about buying time for 4 years, I mean, are you saying then that you would think that in 4 years' time, assuming that Donald Trump were not re-elected as the US president, that TPP would be relaunched in some form?
I would think so. I mean, it took them about 7 to 8 years to come to where they are right now. So if it's going to take another 4 years, if they can delay this, then I would think that it makes sense. Because of that second point that I made just now, where the TPP is a higher level trade agreement in terms of some of the chapters, some of the clauses in this agreement. This is far beyond many of the agreements that we have at the moment, including some of these that are related to the WTO.
As you said before, Australia has been making noises about moving forward with some sort of plan. But one of the things which they had mentioned, and they're not alone in mentioning this, is what's been an elephant in the room with regards to TPP, which is China, and that a future plan might include China. Could this move this week by the White House turn out to be something of a gift to China, given their conspicuous absence from TPP in the first place?
Well, in my opinion, if China is going to come into this, then it is no longer TPP. Because the kind of chapters which is in the TPP is something that probably China would not be willing to concede. For example, you know, there's supposed to be freedom of the labor union as part of the TPP. We know that in China, there is only one labor union, which is basically the Communist Party. So there is no way China is going to kind of give in into those kind of clauses. So if China were to come in, then it's not going to be TPP. And China has its own, you know, there is something else called the RCEP, the Regional Cooperation Partnership or something like that, that China is part of, and China is trying to push that forward. And countries like Australia and New Zealand are part of the RCEP anyway. But of course, the RCEP is not a tight agreement like the TPP. And obviously, you know, countries like China like something where it is only about trade and it is not related to other issues like the environment, like the labor restrictions and so on.
Do you think, just finally, that the US may live to regret this decision that's been made this week?
Well, I mean, if you follow Trump's view of, you know, buy American, hire American, then obviously they're going to be very selective in terms of what kind of agreement that they're going to put moving forward. I think what we have seen over the last decade or so are agreements that comprise of countries that are both developed and developing, right? For example, this TPP. But I think what we're going to see moving forward are actually agreements among developed countries and perhaps maybe among developing countries. Because it is going to be very difficult to put both these kind of countries into one basket because their intentions, their motivations are actually quite different. I mean, you can't have an agreement where you want to, you know, hire more Americans in the U.S. and not allow for other countries to accept investment and trade, for instance. This is going to be very difficult to put this together. And I think that's the reason why, you know, the U.S., for example, might be looking at, for example, an agreement with the UK, a kind of a bilateral agreement with the UK. And I think they will also have a bilateral agreement with Japan. At the moment, the trade agreements that the US has are mainly with smaller countries. They do not have, for example, with Japan, for instance. So I think there's going to be more of these kind of bilateral agreement where Trump can basically negotiate probably better.
Well, likely many changes to come over the next 4 years, I'm sure. Bala Ramasamy, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
That was Bala Ramasamy, Professor of Economics at the China-Europe International Business School in Shanghai, speaking to us from Kuala Lumpur there about the decision by Donald Trump's White House to withdraw the US from the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal this week, and the consequences that will have on the remaining members. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 47 minutes past the hour. Just 4 months after it was set up to counter so-called fake news and Russian propaganda, mainstream media reports this week hailed additional EU funding amounting to hundreds of thousands of euros for the East Stratcom Task Force, a unit set up to monitor and identify specific examples of misinformation. But as our reporter Mark Hurst has been finding out, news of this extra counter-propaganda cash isn't quite what it seems.
Yesterday, it was widely reported that the European Union was to escalate its efforts to, as they see it, counter the Russian hybrid warfare and disinformation campaign by providing an extra €800,000 to the East Stratcom Task Force. The task force, set up last October, was established to monitor and collate evidence of supposed Russian misinformation and propaganda. But 4 months on, and substantive examples of Russian fake news stories has remained elusive, after Stratcom's researchers discovered most fake news was emanating from non-Russian sources. And in a further twist today, when contacted by Radio Sputnik for an interview, a spokesman for the EU, Maja Kosiacic, confirmed that despite widespread mainstream media reporting of this extra funding, no additional monies would be provided to Stratcom. Kosiacic refused to be interviewed or respond to our questions over whether the mainstream media reports highlighting the extra money for Stratcom amounted to fake news in their own right. So can the public tell the difference between what is propaganda and fake news and what is the truth? That is a question I put to Jan Åberg, international mediator and director of the Transitional Foundation in Sweden.
Well, the problem is that ordinary people, simple, good-hearted citizens who sit and watch television, listen to radio, read newspapers, they don't know what they don't get, you see. This is why I think social media and the internet is very important, because here we can find stories, here we can report to each other, here we can share bits and pieces of reality, and we can let people who are basically, let's say, using the traditional media, they can compare for themselves and see, oh, my goodness, here was something interesting on the internet. I never heard that in my radio program or my radio news or my primetime TV news. Why didn't I? You know, that's the beauty of the internet at the moment, until some idiot tries to censor it more systematically, that we now have a way that everybody who is interested, anyone who really wants to know what is going on, can get a fairly, if he or she is willing to do it, a solid searching job, can get a much broader reality or much broader truth than any party, let's say, to a conflict is interested in giving, whether Russia, whether US, whether France or whatever. There is always something cut off that, you know, is not very helpful, not very positive about what we do ourselves. And that's only natural. Every country has done that throughout history.
And you touched on censorship there. Some MEPs from the Baltic states are pushing hard for additional spending to tackle what they believe is Russian misinformation. But is there a risk to genuine press freedoms here? And does the EU effort with the establishment of EastStratcom, does that amount to a form of censorship?
No, I don't think so. I mean, if what they do is basically to say, here is a story about this and that, and we think we can prove that it's false, that's not the same as censorship. Censorship would be to tell editors not to publish a certain thing or to punish somebody who writes an article or whatever, and I don't see anything that they do that points in that direction. You know, if you take the vocabulary here, for instance, you can see it very clearly. The European Union, in its articles and its web place on this, says that we do proactive information and communication, and we do campaigns to provide a positive EU narrative. Now, that's exactly the same that anybody else would do, whereas they would say that Russia or whoever we're talking about, Syria, should not do those types of things. That if they do that, it's propaganda. You see what I mean? And this is the kind of thing they would like to see, some free research, not paid by any of the parties, which is difficult to come by nowadays, where we could see, you know, compare who is doing what on the basis of what budget, and see what is the truth about who is doing propaganda, if we can even define what propaganda is, because, you know, it's all sliding scales. Anything from information to diplomacy, to psyops, to planted stories, to deceptive information, to propaganda, to outright lies. You know, we're talking about a vocabulary here which is very broad, and nobody really defines what is what. So it's a discussion where everybody can buy in, because there's no precision in the terms we use.
And what's your assessment on the EU's general communications strategy over the last few years, given that in many EU states, and even those that are enthusiastic about the European Union, people are generally sceptical about the general competency of the EU? Has it been a failure?
Much of the EU is a failure, and the major failure has been the EU countries intervening in the Middle East and creating the refugee problem that then the same countries and the EU as such is not able to take care of. Any idiot could have predicted that the people would run away from Syria with the way Syria has been treated, or Iraq has been treated, or Libya has been treated. And it's funny to see that this propaganda unit called Stratcom Task Force in the EU is coming up after the Ukraine crisis and in relationship to the refugee, the same year as the refugee crisis in Europe. And if I should be nasty, I would say I smell a rat here. The need for covering up the fact that there are lots of things the EU is not very good at and is in a crisis of, and then you have to blame somebody else for it. I can't say that that is any way scientifically proved, but if I began to look into it, I wonder why was it 2015 the EU found out that it had to combat some kind of what they call Russian propaganda offensive or something like that. And I see now now reference is made to the fact, and it's called fact, although it's not proved as far as I know, that Russia has been hacking in the United States. And we saw what that led to, of all kinds of bad emotions between Russia and the US, and media stating it as if it was a fact. Now, I am very concerned that we are moving into a situation generally where propaganda and marketing companies are earning millions, if not billions of dollars, turning us away from what is some kind of reality. As a researcher, I insist on there being something called facts. And we can't do politics, we can't do public opinion, and we cannot preserve democracy if we are not caring anymore about facts, but are all, you know, more or less using marketing stuff. Even politicians will no longer know what is a fact and what is a propaganda or planted story. And then you know we're in uncharted territory, which will bring us all to hell.
Jan Åberg, it's fascinating insight. Many thanks for joining us on World in Focus today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, and finally. It all started one fateful afternoon in the summer of 2012. I was working as a bellboy at the Trump Hotel in Hong Kong on an internship program. This was my first time in a big city. It was all I could ever have dreamed of and more, but little did I know it was all about to change. That's the opening couple of sentences to Trump Temptation, The Billionaire and the Bellboy by Elijah Daniel. And by all accounts, it's the first in a new genre of Trump-based erotic fiction. One online review said, quote, "This is possibly the most beautiful thing I've ever read this morning, and my passion for pancakes has never been stronger. Unlike that other better-known billionaire-themed erotic novel, I was able to read all of it without wanting to put my fist through a wardrobe door." At just under $2, this might seem like a bargain, but be warned, it's only 10 pages long. And on that note, that is unfortunately all that we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget you can listen again at spoonitnews.com/radio. Until tomorrow, from me, Jack Foster, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Black mayor, black chief of police. I would say the thing that is missing is a black middle class who actually have good manufacturing jobs in the area, which just doesn't exist because of our insane trade policies. We have run up this multi-trillion dollar trade deficit. We buy all this junk from low-wage countries. They end up with our dollars. They don't want to buy anything we make, so they come over here and they buy our buildings and whatnot. You can't have a middle class if you don't have manufacturing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs program, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Hi, this is Max Kaiser for Double Down. New show on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Everybody's doubling down. Central bankers are doubling down. Gambleaholics are doubling down. Everyone's doubling down. Why don't you double down? Right here at Sputnik with a new show called Double Down with Max and Stacey. Bye, y'all.
Catch all the breaking global political and economic news as it happens. Sputnik brings an all-star lineup with expert opinion from some of the biggest names in the news today. Noam Chomsky.
Turkey, U.S. ally, their main goal is to attack the Kurds, the one ground force opposing ISIS. And there have been a kind of a funnel for support of ISIS, not officially, but in practice.
Peter Sunde, co-founder of the Pirate Bay.
We don't have any sort of democratic control over the internet. And I think that we're very naive when we think that the internet itself is intrinsically good. It's not. It's just a very neutral technology that is being used for good things, but more and more being used for evil things.
Icelandic Foreign Minister Gunnar Bragi Sveinsson.
We increase activities in the Keflavik Air Base, and that has to do with more activities from the Russian Northern Fleet in the ocean around Iceland, and also, of course, these usual flights of the bombers.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
We're the ones that destroyed the government of Libya. We're the ones in a pipeline dispute that helped destroy the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. We're the ones who invaded Iraq.
Former U.S. Secretary of Defense William Perry.
The hostile relationship between the United States and Russia today is dangerous for both countries, not because either country would actually want to start a military conflict, but because there's always a danger of blundering.
Sputnik talks to the brightest minds in politics and current affairs to find out what's really happening. Tune in.